Species.
Unite.
I think that's often the solution when feeling sort of bogged down in the issues of our day, is when you zoom out and you look at sort of the whole arc of change, you can sort of get inspired that yeah, we've come a long way.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show.
This conversation is with Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy. Bill is the editorial director of the New York Times Magazine, and Monica is a veterinarian and writer. And their latest book, Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals, comes out today, April 23rd. It's a book about moral change and a moral revolution, one that took place from the 1860s to the 1890s in the U.S. It was a time where the way we treated animals completely changed. It was the birth of the ASPCA, of many SPCAs, of anti-vivisection, which is live testing on animals, of animal shelters. It was a time of massive change. Even though I think most people who listen to this podcast know we need a much bigger moral revolution in terms of how we treat animals, this book gave me so much hope that it can actually be done. Hi, Monica. Hi, Bill. Thank you both for meeting me here today.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We're here to talk about your newest book, your latest book, Our Kindred Creatures, which I loved. But, you know, I'm somebody who spends most of their time immersed in how we treat animals. That's like what I read about, what I write about, what I talk about. And I learned so much from your book, I can't even tell you. I knew in the 1800s the ASPCA started. I knew we got better to horses. But I didn't know we had this big period of like actual moral change. And one thing that that did for me was give me a lot of hope for the future. But I want to go back and talk about it because I figure if I didn't know about all this moral change, not many other people probably are that aware of it either. So let's start with that and maybe start with talking about what you start with in the book, which is sea turtles.
The story of these 100 sea turtles is sort of a remarkable story in the history of animal activism in America. Henry Berg had started the ASPCA just a few months before these turtles arrived in New York, where they were being sold. A lot of people today don't realize just what a big deal turtle soup was. This was just this huge obsession. It was seen as one of the highest delicacies of you know, East Coast cities in the late, you know, mid 1800s. And these turtles had been hunted in Florida. They're treated very roughly. They were inverted on their shells in the ship. There'd been, you know, holes punched in their fins to run cords through them to stop them from moving around. And when Henry Berg, who founded the ASPCA, heard about these turtles, he took some of his agents, because the ASPCA had been essentially deputized as law enforcement around the animal cruelty issue, which was sort of another thing that people don't realize about these early SPCAs and humane societies, is that they were empowered to do police work. They were essentially private police forces for animals, and hauled the captain in front of a judge. This was a really remarkable moment because people of this era had a hard time getting their minds around the moral status of even the horses and dogs that were kind of their closest animal companions. And the idea that you would give that kind of consideration to a turtle was seen as very bizarre. And he lost the case because they determined the defense argued that a turtle was a fish. The judge accepted that argument, which was ridiculous, of course, because even by then, scientists really understood taxonomy reasonably well. A turtle was an animal and deserved to be covered under the statute. But it did cause a huge sensation. And in a certain way, even though horses were really the focus of the campaign, the turtle case was the thing that really created the biggest media sensation around the ASPCA in its early months, and I think wound up being important in spreading the message.
Is that why people don't really eat turtle soup now?
I wish we could say so. I think, though, that culinary fashions changed, and there were fewer turtles. You know, it used to be that hunters could just go to nesting grounds in Florida during the right season and just flip turtle after turtle onto her back when she came up onto the sand to lay eggs and just grab them and fill ships with them in order to, you know, turn a great profit. And I think it became less profitable over time to do that.
So this was like 1860s. So we're after the Civil War. Europe, England had already started a lot of animal welfare campaigns and work in this. What took us so long and like what sparked it all?
Well, I mean, I think that the Civil War, obviously, I think was, you know, the and not just the Civil War, but the run-up to the Civil War. I mean, one of the things that's sort of fascinating when you really research the humanitarian movements of this era is you see a lot of the same names, right? Like, not everybody was involved in every single issue, but there was a lot of overlap. And of course, in this country, you know, the fight against slavery by the 1840s and the 1850s was just incredibly consuming for everybody who had sort of what you might think of as kind of progressive politics. And so I don't think it's very surprising that it took until the end of the war for this to really take off. And I think when it did, there was just a lot of energy and a lot of inspiration. I mean, I think that there was optimism that things were going to go better, you know, with the aftermath of slavery than wound up happening in reality. And there was a sort of sense of like, you know, we did it. Where should all of this like moral fervor go? And for a lot of people, or for a significant chunk of people, the answer was into, you know, the campaign against cruelty to animals. And so you really see, particularly in the first 10 years, give or take, you know, 1866 to 1876, you really just see so much remarkable energy. You know, the ASPCA, you know, they put the word American in their name, but really they only covered New York State. And so people basically just sort of took inspiration from it. Some of them came and visited the ASPCA to just get a sense for how they had done it. But then you have Massachusetts founds one, you have Pennsylvania founds one, and San Francisco happens early on. And before you know it, you have these organizations covering like a significant portion of the country. And again, they're coming not just with, you know, they're not protesting or whatever. They're coming with laws and agents who are empowered to go out and begin to enforce cruelty in the streets. And with it, the norms change too. And that's, I think, another underappreciated aspect of this is how, you know, people maybe in their hearts, I think, kind of knew that some of what they were seeing was wrong, but this movement gave people license to shame people who were beating their animals. I think it did change hearts and minds in addition to changing laws.
Right.
And one thing that's sort of wonderful but also heartbreaking about this period is the, as deserving as the animal cause was to absorb this activist energy and bring about like a moral revolution, there were other really good causes that were sort of on offer to absorb some of the hearts and minds and also get more traction, like the fight for women's rights and other really important social movements, labor and
right.
You talk about in the book too, which I was shocked, but there was nothing, no laws preventing cruelty to children.
Children, right? Yes, right.
Well, and the movement to fight cruelty to children literally grows out of the animal welfare movement because, you know, the very first case of prosecution of cruelty to children, which I think we're at an anniversary year for that, right? I think it was 1874 and we're now 2024. So I think it's what's that,
150 years.
Yeah. You know, Henry Berg, you know, over the years, people have said, hey, you know, there's this case of cruelty to children happening. Could you all get involved? And he would say, no, no, that's not our department. But then eventually he decides he's going to do it. He sends ASPCA agents to rescue this girl from an abusive home. They win the case. And then they essentially start not part of the ASPCA, but they start what's called the SPCC, which is the Society to Prevent Cruelty to Children. And that itself launches a movement. And the other thing that really blew our minds was that in a number of places, you know, especially the ones that had the SPCAs for a long time, the two societies stayed separate, but that in many, many cities, there were, and they tended to be called humane societies, they were dedicated to both. So we write about the Illinois Humane Society in the book, where a few years after they found it, they say, hey, we're going to protect children too. And so the agents, you know, they get tips about cruelty to animals and they get tips about cruelty to children, and they go off and they investigate the one, they investigate the other, and it's all part of the same kind of campaign.
It's completely crazy.
Yeah. You know?
And the fact that they were the law, right?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. It wasn't really, you weren't calling the police.
Right.
Yeah, that's
for
right.
For this stuff, especially with the children's stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people took them seriously. Right. They had to. It's really amazing. You do this incredible chapter on New York, of all the absolutely insane things that we're doing to animals. One of the ones that sticks out to me the most is that at 4 o'clock every day, people running to the animal shelter or whatever it's called, the pound, if their dog's there, because all the dogs get drowned at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Just awful.
Yeah, it's really terrible. Yeah.
People are stealing people's dogs, right? Because it's, how does that work? Like, you're paying for it.
Because the city will pay for dogs to be hauled off the street and dropped off at the pound. At the time, you know, the concern around rabies and loose dogs and bites, you know, had some legitimacy, but by offering a reward, it sort of was a perverse incentive so that dogs could be snatched in order to get an easy, you know, reward from the city. So you have this mix of stray dogs, but loved dogs sort of here in the pound. And if people don't figure out where the dog is and reclaim him in time, he can be part of the group that's drowned at the end of the day, since there weren't really holding facilities to sort of keep the dogs for a while and allow people to reconnect.
Yeah, that's just like sick. The horses, I guess, were the biggest deal because it was so in front of everybody. Right. And we talk about like some of just the abject cruelty that went on with the horses.
Well, the horses were primary movers of the city. So even though we're in the industrial age at this time and there are steam engines and they power machinery inside factories and they power the railroads, they all run on coal that have to be brought by horse wagon. The horses are also running transit because most of the streetcars are pulled by horses on rails. Some are pulled on wheels along the road, along with individual carriers and riders on their horses. So people who are in traffic jams or who are under pressure from a boss to get the goods delivered on time, right in front of everybody, are beating the horses, hurting the horses in an effort to get them to move, even if they're not feeling well, or make them go faster, work harder. And the early animal activists felt for the horses, of course, but they also thought the spectacle of seeing someone be cruel to a horse, like right in front of everybody, was bad for society, that it was sort of morally degrading to sort of witness that and not do anything about it. And so that action in the streets, which was something I think every New Yorker saw as a sort of regular thing, meaning they day after day would be faced with this particular type of cruelty. That was the focus of early animal welfare activists.
There's truth in that in the sense of violence begets violence, mm-hmm. right? And we know it with slaughterhouse workers now that the levels of domestic violence are much higher because violence is normalized, right? And not that they're, I'm not, like, it's not, nobody wants to be a slaughterhouse worker.
Right.
But I'm just saying that we have a lot of research on that. I don't know about watching violence, but I would assume watching violence doesn't make you a sweeter person.
No, of course not. I mean, Yeah, they are sort of onto something. When I sort of encounter, not usually in real life, but, you know, I read about an act of animal cruelty, I identify with the animal, I feel compassion for the animal. And I guess I hadn't, when I read about the reaction of these early animal welfare activists, it is a little different from ours. Like they're not only sad for the animal, but they like are really disgusted with cruelism, as they call it. And they feel like the sort of, you know, degradation of that person's soul and everyone who witnesses it is sort of the greater evil. They sort of take the focus off the victim, sort of onto the perpetrator,
right.
Which, you know, I guess motivated them a lot to do a lot of prosecutions and and probably helps a lot of animals. But it was a different orientation towards animal cruelty than I think most of us hold today. And it was a little weird to come to understand.
It's totally weird. But I would think if that's the only thing everybody ever knew, right, or that's what people had grown up watching, that it to step out of it, the people who step out of it now even, mm-hmm. like it, and depending on where you are and who you are and how your relationship with animals, we still accept a lot of normalized violence, right, even on our mm-hmm. plates. It is weird, right? Like, it's all weird that, like, what we accept and don't accept mm-hmm. and how that's why I'm so fascinated by your book, like, how those changes are made and how, and all the other things that it takes. The other thing about the horses that I had no idea, which I probably should have, was Black Beauty. I did not know that Black Beauty had this massive effect on everyone. I thought it was just like a great book.
Well, and what's really funny about it is, you know, it was an English book. It was set in England. It was published in the 1877, and it was reasonably successful in England, but it wasn't published in the United States for 13 years. And what happens in 1890 is George Angel, who's one of the main characters of our book, he's the head of the Massachusetts SPCA. Someone gives him a copy of the book and he looks at it and he says to himself, you know, everybody was obsessed with the role that Uncle Tom's Cabin had played in the sort of rallying of America, of, you know, Northern Americans before the Civil War against slavery. And he had started this magazine. They'd published some fiction. He was really a big believer in using kind of writing and literature to inspire people to be kind to animals. And he had always wanted to have a novel that could do for horses what Uncle Tom's Cabin had done sort of, you know, to America around the fight against slavery. And he sees this book and he says, this is my, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin of the Horse. They literally print that on the book. And he just starts printing copies of it. He doesn't get the copyright. He just pirates it. He starts publishing like tens of thousands of copies immediately. And within like, I don't know, 6 to 9 months or something, it has sold, you know, 500,000 copies, which is more than Uncle Tom's Cabin sold during its first year. And it becomes one of the best-selling books of the 19th century, entirely based on this kind of activist campaign, which is entirely pirated.
Yeah,
the original English publisher saw no proceeds from it, and people start, you know, translating it and publishing it in other language. It becomes a sort of movement thing in the 1890s, and that's really the thing that made it into an international sensation.
It's incredible. And this is also a major reason people started being a lot nicer to horses.
Well, George Angel thought so. It does seem like in this era, people like loved sentimental sort of literature and really like read with their hearts. So,
well, and they had a different attitude towards literature, right? I mean, it was seen as a tool for moral improvement and instruction, not just by, you know, goody-goody types, but by almost everybody. It was, you know, literature was seen as a tool for moral improvement, which is partly why sometimes when we go back and we look at these old books, or we think of Black Beauty as a book for children. And partly the reason that that's the case, even though it wasn't written for children, is that it all seems so kind of sentimental and didactic, like it's trying to lead you so much to feeling a certain way and changing your opinion a certain way. But that was really how they thought about literature in that time period.
I never read Black Beauty, so I had no idea that it was told by the horse. Mm-hmm. The part that you put in the book about the horse getting its tail cut off and going through the bone, and it's not really a kid's book, right?
No,
it's
vicious.
It takes a lot of things to create this kind of change, but to create this kind of change for 30 years, where really we went from animals were vermin pretty much across the board to at least liking some. And since then, really liking some, you know.
I think that partly because of how they thought about cruelism, that unfortunately they were sort of satisfied with some types of cruelty being moved out of public view. And we think about the slaughterhouses specifically here, because we're also seeing during this time, it's moving from like before refrigeration to after refrigeration. And as a consequence of that, live animals, sea turtles, cattle, pigs, aren't being moved into cities anymore, but their products are being moved into cities. And the industrialization of the meat industry is happening. And most of these animal welfare activists didn't sort of continue the fight against the meat industry once that was all sort of moved away from population centers and people weren't sort of witnessing the cruelism anymore.
But even when the meat industry was in the cities, the animals were treated just as, I mean, they weren't treated well.
Oh, no. Yeah.
A lot of what happens as the sort of industrial meat industry takes shape is it's really just about scale. It all has to become sort of more factory-like and more assembly line, you know? So I'm sure that in certain ways, you know, during the slaughtering process, I'm sure that individual butchers in the city might have been treating animals just as bad or worse as these kind of assembly line places were. But what you really saw was they would just set up these systems to just, you know, to just kill animals so quickly. They didn't really think very much about their experience or obviously. And the scale is the thing that's just really jaw-dropping, you know, as you move from, say, the 1860s to the 1880s and the 1890s, is everything becomes centralized in the Midwest, specifically in Chicago. Meatpacking begins to take off in these cities so that the animals are all being slaughtered kind of in these like relatively closed off areas where everybody's being sort of paid to be part of the system. And it isn't really until Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, which was, you know, based on his own experience sort of hanging around in the meatpacking industry, does the public really understand sort of just how, mostly what they're outraged by is the sanitary conditions. But the book also really is vivid about, you know, the screams of the animals and how little thought that the workers had for any of them and the corruption of the bosses. And that did lead to some changes, mostly sanitation changes, but it did also, I think, shine a light on what was going on in those places.
And is that when we started like stunning before slitting throats?
The Humane Slaughter Act is until the 1950s, and that's when it becomes federal law that the animals have to basically be insensible before they are slaughtered. So, right, with the cows, it's now the captive bolt gun. I think that with pigs now, it's partly electrocution and partly like gas chamber, like, you know.
It is gas chambers.
Yeah, type thing. But yeah, before that, it was certainly way worse, and the pigs would just be hauled up by their leg, and then their throats would be cut, and then they would, if they were lucky, they would be dead before they were dumped into boiling water for the bristles to be scraped off their skin. So,
that's it.
Our book it has some of these details, but it also has lots of other stuff.
It's very hopeful. It doesn't sound hopeful the way we're talking about it, but like I finished your book with great feelings of hope because I'm so immersed in this. And I do believe in humans and moral change and all of that, or I wouldn't be doing this in the first place. But I also have big faith in tech, right? Cultivated meat, leathers made from plants, all that kind of stuff that's coming. And mm-hmm. I do think will really be big solves mm-hmm. for a ton of the cruelty that animals experience right now. But your book really made me remember what moral change is and that it happens and that there we do have big shifts in consciousness as a whole culture, as a whole society. And I kind of forgot about that in a way because I'm so immersed in the day-to-day of what we're doing to animals.
I think that's often the solution when feeling sort of bogged down in the issues of our day is when you zoom out and you look at sort of the whole arc of change, you can sort of get inspired that yeah, we've come a long way.
At the end of the book, you talk about pets and how almost absurd we've become with our pets, and that our pets eat better food than a lot of humans eat, which is true, right? Mm-hmm. Or more expensive. And you have a line, you say, love your neighbor as thy pet.
Right. Right.
But there's truth in it, because, and I would love to hear from both of you on this, about this, your circle expanding and where it was back then, mm-hmm. and where we are now in terms of, because in a lot of ways we've expanded, but we're more isolated. And that's a little dangerous too, I think.
I think that's right. One of the sort of most basic changes that you see happen just during the time period that we're writing about, but especially in the present day, is that an American in the 1860s might have more exposure to animals in a way than sort of anybody at any time in human history, right? Because, you're not on a farm where the only animals are your own mm-hmm. farm animals. You're in a city, but there's just animals everywhere. And then, of course, out in the wilds of America, you still have just much more fulsome populations of wildlife. And that by the beginning of the 20th century, or it's really more sort of say by the 1930s or something like that, the animals are mostly out of the cities. And in the whole country is becoming much less agricultural. And then meanwhile, we're sprawling out into the open spaces and the wild animal populations are declining. And so we've sort of gotten to this point where the circle of animals that we are exposed to just physically has gotten narrower and narrower. And that I think is, activism I think played a big part, but partly why we have this weird kind of bifurcated feeling or lack thereof about animals is that we've become sort of ever more invested in the few of them that are in our lives. And then meanwhile, everything else is just kind of an abstraction. And, the butter comes to the grocery store, or the meat comes to the grocery store in these antiseptic packages. And you don't even really have to think, a cow made that. This came from a cow. And so I do think that there's this new, it just becomes more of a challenge to try to keep expanding our circles when we're expanding them to creatures that are they're abstractions that, we learned as children what their sounds are, but we almost never meet them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because I'm a veterinarian in practice, I talk to dog and cat people every day and hear about their obsessions, which I mostly find, super sweet and touching. But every once in a while, it's things get a little weird. I do wish that we could push harder to bring some of that feeling for other species, sort of out of our homes into not only domestic animals, but wild animals, including the least attractive ones. So I hope, we try to end our book on a note of reminding folks about that.
In your book, in that same time mm-hmm. frame is when conservation really started, the whole movement. And it was the same kind of thing. At least some people cared about wild animals mm-hmm. as well. And now we have an incredible conservation moment, but we're still losing. We're killing all our wild animals. We really are at alarming rates, especially wolves. And so it's kind of the same thing. It's we had this kind of moral awakening. But very similar to today, we've almost gone over the top with dogs, cats, horses, et cetera, in terms of giving them bedrooms or whatever, right? And we have all, we know intellectually, humans know that a wolf is as smart as a dog, or that a pig is as smart as a dog, or that they feel the same emotions, that they feel a lot of the same emotions we do, probably all of the same emotions because they're mammals. Yet somehow our brains, most people, are just so compartmentalized into these animals count and these don't. And so I think part of we needed that big step up in the 1860s to the 90s, and then the 90s till now. But now we need this much bigger one in the sense of expansion. And because not only is it massively cruel, but we're going to lose the planet over it. or at least our role in the planet over it. The planet will probably still be okay. But like everything we're doing to animals, we're doing to ourselves and we're doing to the planet. You talk about this a little bit at the end as well. And that's, does that create any big change at some point, do you think? Or what do you see?
I think the big challenge, right, and this isn't just about animals, climate change is really the most dramatic example of it, is that we don't do systemic thinking really well, right? Like even if we intellectually go to school and we learn about how systems work and we kind of understand, you know, okay, I eat a hamburger and not just does that like indirectly lead to death for a sentient creature, you know, hundreds of miles away or possibly multiple of them given the way meat gets made, but they create methane and they work and the fossil fuels that go into growing all of the, you know, the incredible amount of stuff that they have to eat to put on all that weight, like in turn warms the planet, the climate effects of the things that we buy, it all is just, it's so indirect, it's so mediated, and that's just not how our moral senses, it's not how they evolve to work, it's not really how they work intellectually. I think, and I do think that the challenge, and this is something we write about in the conclusion of the book, that trying to think systemically about what our responsibilities are in the world, I think that undergirds like a lot of what you might call kind of progressive reformist movements today, is trying to push people to think systemically about the consequences of their actions, and that it's worth us like being honest about how foreign that is, I think, for most people. It's hard to make our brains work that way. I do think that there's this process of kind of training ourselves to think that way, which I think a lot of us to some degree or other have tried to do around a number of issues, but certainly environmental and climate issues being a big one. I think that there's a shift going on. I'd like to think that there's a shift going on that really is about that kind of systemic thinking, that sense. And I do think that every generation is sort of more aware of the systemic nature of problems than the one that preceded it, and the sense that you have a responsibility to do something, even if you can't see the, or to not do something, even if you can't see the negative effect of what you do. I'd like to feel like that every generation is becoming more comfortable with the idea that that's how problems in this like globalized, you know, hyper-capitalist, but even just, I mean, it's not even just capitalism, it's just the globalized high-tech world that we live in, that's how problems are. And it's like, we have to kind of develop a moral sense to match.
That's true. I'm sure this book was a very long process. How long did you spend on this?
It's about
book?
5 years and all.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
It's massive. And it's so much really interesting and good information. After spending 5 years kind of immersed in that kind of change 150 years ago, how do you feel about change now? Like, hopeful?
Yes, hopeful.
Yeah, I think I am more hopeful than I might have been when I started. You do realize that we do individually and collectively just have a lot of power for moral change, and that feeling of being mired. I mean, one thing that I you definitely feel, and this is something you also see, you know, if you read about the history of the, you know, civil rights movement or pick your activist crusade, is that you have these moments in the middle where you see the activists going just like, nothing's changing. We keep beating our heads against the wall. We think we're doing everything right. Why? Like, we see just how much injustice there is around this issue, and why doesn't everybody else see it? And then you look back and then you say, oh, you know, you won that argument. You know, the thing you wanted to change, it did change. It just took another 20 years. It took much longer. It kept going on way past the point when any reasonable person thought it should keep going, but then it stopped. I'd like to believe that. So I'm hopeful that we will maybe, you know, maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's 50 years, that people will look back on this moment around climate change in particular. But I think there's a lot of animal issues that are caught up in the same processes that we changed.
The time period we write about, I mean, we picked it because it really, when we started looking at it, it really was a moral revolution. Like, you know, sort of attitudes went into this period one way and they came out totally transformed. And it's because we care about animals, like, it's super interesting to sort of dig deeper there and see how that happened. But we, like, are looking for lessons that can be applied to sort of important issues more generally, because like I mentioned a few minutes ago, like, there were lots of important issues that needed to be aired at that point in history. And it wasn't maybe their moment yet. You know, women didn't get the vote for many decades after, you know, 1866, when the ASPCA started. But you know, sort of studying the how movements sort of build up a head of steam and really change hearts and minds quickly, I think, you know, will hopefully sort of bring more energy and more sort of possibility to all the things we care about now and want to see changed. And so that's why we researched it. And we hope that's, you know, something that people are reading it, thinking about too.
No, 1,000%. I like finished your book feeling very hopeful. All of a sudden, I started believing in humanity again. Not that I haven't, but in a different way. Like, it just made me, it was like this remembering, like, hey, we do change. So thank you for everything and putting it out in the world. And yeah, thank you very much, both of you, for today and all of it. To learn more about Bill and Monica and to read our kindred creatures, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Sam Kosel, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.